Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He is author, leading global finance blogger, and I call him America's philosopher. Welcome, Charles.
Well, thank you, Richard, for inviting me on the program, and I'm not sure I can live up to that high praise, but I'll give it a try.
Okay, great. Today we thought have a discussion on central bank policies and how that all relates to financial repression from a social and economic perspective. So we have repressed interest rates. We've had that for many years. Lots of quantitative easing going on with central banks, not only in the U.S. with the Federal Reserve, but other central banks, and a lot of distortions in the economy have happened in the financial markets as well. How do you price risk? How do you price interest rates? Given all those challenges, it's created a lot of distortions. Your thoughts on that, Charles?
Well, Richard, that's a great summary of the forces which are distorting, decision making and capital allocation. And so, I'll try to address this huge number of topics that we could talk about, and start with what are the engines of inequality? Like, we all are aware now that wealth and income inequality has been rising in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are connecting the dots between rising inequality and central bank policy. And we could explore a little bit of those inner connections. I have a chart of wages as a percentage of GDP, and this is an interesting measure of wages, because it's basically a very broad based way of saying how much of the economic activity in a nation is ending up in the hands of wage earners, as opposed to owners of capital or rent seekers.
Yeah.
And of course, we might want to differentiate that. And there's an interesting, there was a post on Zero Hedge just today with Angus Deaton, the economist who's basically blasting rent seekers. And of course, we want to differentiate between rent seeking, which is monopolies and cartels that basically get the government to protect their income streams and eliminate competition, as opposed to, the innovative, creative destruction side of capitalism, where growth and income inequality might be rising because the most talented and the most successful at allocating capital are benefiting. And so we can see that both of those forces are at work. In other words, a lot of people have noted that the top 5% of the wage earners, the professional class, the entrepreneurial class, those people are scooping up most of the gains in wages, right? And so the bottom 90 to 95% are seeing stagnating wages. And so we want to ask, well, what's going on there? Is it just positive capitalism at work, where there's creative destruction of lower value jobs, and more of the gains are going to the high performing part of the workforce? And we can say, well, yeah, sure, there's lots of evidence for that. But if we look at this chart I referred to, GDP, the percentage of wages as part of the whole overall economy, it's been declining since 1970.
Yeah.
So something else is going on. And I'd be interested in your view on, how does that relate to central bank policy? You know, in other words, why are wages declining for decades? You know, and there may be booms and busts and so on, but that's a generational trend, you know, and clearly it's connected to policies, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, just for everybody also on the podcast, we encourage you to download the slides that have been provided by Charles in terms of the great insight here, and so that can be downloaded from the website at any time, or read through the blog podcast abstract transcript that we have also on the website. But yeah, that's a great observation, Charles. I mean, the idea that 1970-71 coincides with the essential decoupling of the U.S. dollar and from gold at that time. So that was a significant point and coincides with the chart that you show. And so from that point, it all comes down to central banking policies and lots of interventions by the central bank, the Federal Reserve in the U.S. So that type of mechanism we see as having been influential on this whole economic evolution.
Right. And then we can also look at just debt. In other words, what's the primary function of the central bank policies of the last few decades? And it seems clear from the charts, from the data, that it's the expansion of debt. It's facilitating the expansion of debt at a rate that's far faster than the expansion of GDP. And so I have a couple of charts here that we've all seen before but are still striking if you look at them with new eyes. I have a chart here of global bond market, which of course is debt basically the sale or the creation of debt instruments. And so from 1990, which isn't that long ago, there was about $10 trillion in global bond market debt, and now it's pushing $100 trillion. So yeah, we have to ask: did all the major economies of the world did their GDP go up tenfold? And we'd have to say no. And then we look at U.S. Sovereign debt, you know, the public debt, and from around that same period, 1990, it was about $3 trillion. And now it's pushing $20 trillion. So we can kind of follow that narrative and say, what happens when debt is rewarded and the acquisition of debt is easy for those closest to the money spigot? And my conclusion is that if you don't change the way that money is created and distributed, then you really – haven't changed anything. Mm-hmm. And so what I see is a tremendous conservation, if you will, of central bank policy. You know, over the last, say, 20 to 30 years, central banks have maintained the exact same policy, right, which is to lower interest rates. That's a 30-year trend, and make it easier for banks and corporations and financiers to borrow money. And so this is, to me, one of the key drivers in wealth and income inequality, because as I've often noted, if you and I could go borrow $1 billion at 0.5% interest, well, then guess what? We can go and buy a treasury bill at a treasury bond at 3% and earn 2.5% for doing nothing.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, so that the rent seeking, the exploitive part of the economy, that used to be a relatively modest percentage of the economy. In other words, an economy can thrive if there's a relatively modest class of rent seekers, right? But when that class starts growing to 10 to 15 to 20% of the economy, it's basically sucking all the oxygen out of the room and leaving less actual capital for innovators. And you and I were speaking before we started recording about national policies that seek out innovators and want to encourage them. And what we have in the U.S. is we have a system where if you're already extremely wealthy and you're like you're a bank or a financier, then the Federal Reserve policies have enabled you to enlarge your rent seeking at the expense of everybody else, that's especially wage earners.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole concept, as you earlier alluded, the idea that increasing levels of debt are actually yielding less and less of an oomph in terms of economic growth over time, essentially requiring more and more debt to get the same level of increase in economic activity. Well, at some point it goes to zero, right? So you have the need to create an infinite level of debt, an infinite increase in debt for that, just a small increase in economic activity. We're essentially approaching that point now.
Right. Yeah, absolutely, Richard. Excellent point. And I have a couple of charts here that show global debt, however you want to measure it, sovereign debt, private debt, corporate debt. Hopefully, you know, we combine all of them, right?
Yeah.
And the mix in each nation can be a little different, but the debt has soared. And then we look at the global financial assets, which have also soared, but not by the same amount. And I'm looking at a chart from MarketWatch, 2015 of global financial assets. And in 2005, which was just barely a decade ago, total assets of bonds, stock market, mm-hmm. non-financial corporate bonds, and so on, well, 178 trillion globally. Now it's pushing 300 trillion. So there's been a healthy expansion, but the as you say, it's completely asymmetric to the amount of debt that's increased. And so we look at, say, just in China, they've within a decade, their total debt load has gone from around 3 trillion, I believe, and converted to U.S. dollars to 30 trillion. And a lot of other nations have followed that same pattern of debts skyrocketed, and the assets have gone up, but not by the same proportion. And so if we look at a chart of I believe it's from it's from Emmanuel Saez and Piketty, mm-hmm. Thomas Piketty, that distribution of wealth in the U.S. since 1917. And of course, we all know that wealth inequality spiked just before the Great Depression, late 20s, and then it favored the bottom 90% most in the 70s and 80s, and then about 1990, in what I would call the era of neoliberalism and extremely aggressive central bank expansion of debt. It's gone against wage earners, and it's favored the top 0.1% immensely, as they've seen their share go from about 10% of wealth to 22%. And of course, this is and where the wealth of wage earners, the bottom 90%, has fallen from the high 30s or mid 30s to 20 to the low 20s, and so. We can perhaps extrapolate these vast changes in wealth and income inequality and ask, what are the social consequences? And of course, a lot of people are saying what seems to be obvious, which is the election of Trump and the perhaps Brexit and a lot of the rise of the so-called right parties in Europe are all connected to the social disorders that are arising from this wealth inequality. And do you see this same narrative, as being valid?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a lot of misunderstanding out there in the economy and what's happening by central banks, the activities. There's a potential for misattribution by the general public on why the financial crisis happened, on why income wealth inequality is getting worse. I mean, in the U.S. now, the Gini coefficient measuring the sort of distance between wealthy and poor is now worse than it is in Mexico. So both Canada and Mexico have a larger, broader-based middle class than the U.S., you know, if you, which, you know, wasn't the case just, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago. And I think a lot of that has been through the central bank policies, as the example you gave earlier. Those with access close to the money printing can benefit, you know, with low interest rates, doing essentially investing with little or no risk by borrowing low and investing at higher yields. And then also those with assets that can benefit from asset inflation, also benefiting even more. So that, you know, these type of effects, as well as things like the corporate share buybacks, you know, we're borrowing at low interest rates to prop up, you know, stock prices. There's been estimated to be $620 billion of that over the last year alone, you know, propping up stock prices even higher for those with assets.
You know, that's an excellent point, Richard. And you know, the mainstream media, it's again one of the vacuum holes in the mainstream financial press, that they don't really explain that, you know, that the wealth effect really has only benefited those who already own access or who have access to cheap credit, and then they can use that cheap credit to buy assets that then go up. And and of course we see this in real estate, that if you are a financier or a corporation and you have access to tens of millions of dollars of credit, then you can go snap up apartment buildings and assets that then create an income stream, and that you're basically outbidding anybody that is a small, you know, like a household or a small company. And so this is where the central bank has created a vast social injustice. And we don't usually connect the word injustice to central banks, but really that's what's going on. And that's why the social cohesion is being lost, is people feel, even if they can't articulate it, they recognize that these central bank policies are exacerbating social injustices, because they're basically, the rich are getting richer at the expense of everyone else. And so the fallacy, I think it's worth mentioning, the central bank idea was, if we create all this new wealth in the wealthy class, some of it's going to trickle down and benefit the bottom 90 to 95%. But I think the history of the 21st century has shown that trickle down effect is very modest, and it's not something the central bank controls. In other words, the central bank can control how much credit is available to corporations and banks, but it can't control how much of all that money trickles down to the bottom 90% in wages. And so that's a structural flaw in the central bank policy. And another flaw I think we should mention, since we're talking about financial repression, is Timothy Geithner wrote a long essay recently in Foreign Affairs magazine, and it was about how do we avoid, or how do we deal with the next financial crisis. And I found it interesting, because many of us find few things to agree with Timothy Geithner, who basically oversaw the bailout of the entire entire financial system to the benefit of people who should have maybe taken some losses. They were all bailed out. But he said, you know, the financial systems are inherently fragile, and so we're going to have financial crises. They are built in. They're cooked in. You can't avoid them. And I thought, well, this is something I can agree on, and many people recognize this. Nassim Taleb, for instance, whose book Anti-Fragile suggests that the way that you deal with financial crises is you basically force people to take losses all the way along the line. In other words, you don't create moral hazard and bail people out, or make it easy for people to escape losses or mask them, because then you pile up a lot of bad debt and risk that's hidden. And then, and so Geithner's idea, basically, if you strip away all of his other verbiage, he's basically saying, well, we need to backstop the whole financial system again. We always will have to backstop it with the state treasury and the central banks. And I think many of us feel that that's one of those definitions of insanity, right? You keep doing what's failed. And so
privatizing gains and socializing losses is the
yes, exactly, that's right. And so he didn't mention in his 5,000 word essay or whatever, inequality did not come up at all. That was like, in other words, to people, the policy makers at this high level of central banks, they don't seem to address that, because perhaps because they know they've failed in that area and that it's a problem they really don't seem to have any control over or influence on.
Yeah. And how do you see this all playing out, I guess, in the political arena? I mean, could there be even backlash on the current U.S. administration to a movement to the far left, perhaps being driven by the millennials? Do you see that happening?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, Richard, and I don't have a definitive answer for sure, because one of some of the studies I've seen, and of course it's largely anecdotal, but millennials apparently are quite financially conservative. They tend to have savings. They tend to be careful with their money, and they're well aware that the generational burden is falling on them. So I'm not sure that they will cleave to any of the partisan sort of political lines that we're used to, you know. It's interesting though, because the millennials obviously favored Bernie Sanders' more socialist agenda.
Yeah.
But if the way I read that is, Bernie Sanders' agenda was recognizing these vast inequalities as social injustices, like we were talking about.
Yeah.
And so the central banks need to stop rewarding the rent seekers, and they need to start supporting the innovators. And central banks, they basically have a sledgehammer. They've got a dial for buying assets, and they've got a dial for interest rates. And they don't really have as much control over these consequences of their policies. And so I can see the millennials being interested in the social socialist agenda, in the sense that it reduces the inequality and injustice that is rising. But they may very well be conservative financially, and that would make policies that – were conservative in terms of reducing debt and that kind of thing, that might be appealing to them too. So there may be a hybrid political solution going forward.
Interesting. So like, what would you prescribe as overall recommendations in terms of, you alluded to earlier, like the innovation area, regulations that are serving as regulatory capture, you know, by industries in terms of preventing small, medium-sized players from entering markets to the benefit of the larger, companies or organizations. So you have some regulatory issues, the innovation issues, education and training issues. How do you see that?
Well, that's a great question, and I think two things occur to me that could be solutions going forward. One is to just get rid of central banks or limit them to perhaps what was their original function, which was providing liquidity in liquidity crises.
Yes.
But they've got a hammer, and so they see nails everywhere. In other words, every crisis they deal with as a liquidity crisis, as opposed to a collateral or leverage crisis. And so if they were limited to only responding to liquidity crises, which would tend to be short, you know, tend to be a few months as panic arises and then panic recedes as people have access to emergency credit lines. They can roll over debt and so on. Get rid of the rest of their mandate to manipulate interest rates and repress savings and all their other negative consequences. So if we went back to a market that was of capital that was private, then that would instantaneously remove a lot of the benefits that rent seekers get from central bank policy, and that everyone would have a transparent market for capital. And that would allow smaller enterprises to have basically the same access at the same rate. There might be some variations, of course, but that would open up the capital markets to innovators in a way that the central banks have repressed. Mm-hmm. And that would also a private market for capital. People would start paying for capital, meaning that savers would start getting some of the benefit that's been taken away from them by zero interest rate policy. And then my last thought is, like a lot of people, I see a huge potential benefit to innovators and small enterprises in decentralized cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, Ethereum, mm-hmm. Dash, and that these currencies have a great value because they're outside the control of these central banks. And so if we could decentralize money and decentralize capital, then I think we'd be opening the doors to a lot of solutions.
Yeah, interesting. Finally, how do you see all of this playing out in the investment environment? All of these distortions, what is it having an effect on in the investment and the financial markets? And I mean, how do you see it playing out over the near to medium term?
Well, I wish I had a better crystal ball, but I think like a lot of people, I see these distortions as building up systemic risk that's beneath the surface. And so right now, basically, you could say that central bank policy is all about masking risk, right? It's by flooding the market with liquidity, then you basically mask the risk that's piling up underneath. And so eventually that risk bursts out, you know, like water in a corroded pipe or a dam or something, some other physical analogy. And so when that happens, it's very hard to time that because it's partly based on human emotion. In other words, people go from euphoria to panic, and that process is not terribly predictable.
Yeah.
But clearly that the systemic risk is rising because the systemic debt is rising, the systemic leverage is rising, the systemic level of bad debt, the debt that's unpayable, all of those things are rising at the same time that the as you said, the benefits of adding more debt to the system are diminishing. So we've got mm-hmm. diminishing returns. So there's going to have to be a reckoning or a banquet of consequences that we're forced to sit down and consume. And when that happens, I don't know, but certainly within the next few years. It seems impossible to dodge it for another few years, but I've been wrong before. So mm-hmm. it might be, you know, 4 years out, 5 years out, but there will be a banquet of consequences, and we can see it being prepared right now.
Wow, that's quite interesting insight. Great. And how can our listeners learn more about your work, Charles?
Please visit me at oftwominds.com.
Great. Thank you very much, Charles. We'll talk again in a few more weeks.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.